are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 16th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Eric Levitz. He is a writer for New York Magazine, and we are talking about why the cons can't figure out the Nordics. Are they socialist hellscapes or free market utopias? All that, plus the Trump administration is making another move to strip away consumer protections and health care under Obamacare. That and the Supreme Court, and we will probably talk a little Omarosa drama. Plus, Donald Trump has stripped John Brennan's security clearance. This is a resistance story, just perfection for everybody involved. We'll get into that. There are ongoing bombings of civilian targets in Yemen, including a couple days ago a school bus which killed 44 children. The United States and the UK are refueling and providing arms for the Saudis and the UAE, and some members of Congress seem to be slightly concerned about this. Talk about that. CEO pay jumps $19 million annually as fears mount over the wealthy pocketing gains. Real shocker there that with deregulation and tax redistribution to the top, that the money would go to the top.
I don't love that.
I mean, I do, but yeah, right. That is what he would say to, what's this I hear about all the money going to the top? I don't love that. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that the SEC is about to subpoena Tesla about its CEO buyout plans, even as Azalea Banks accuses Elon Musk and Grimes of giving her a get out weekend.
Oh, I knew you were going to do that story. I love it.
It's a good story. Steve Bannon mounts a last-ditch effort to save Trump. And Trump loyalists are already talking a Bill Clinton 1998 scenario with Trump. Andrew Cuomo says something slightly sensible about the history of the country. And the right wing is freaking out. Reminder, he's still awful. Lula has been registered as a presidential candidate in a battle that was won yesterday for the forces of democracy restoration in Brazil, even as the struggle continues. And Liz Brunig turns Laura Ingraham into a stammering mess when she breaks down socialism on Fox News. All that and more on today's Majority Report. We are three. Sam is out attempting to freshen up his wardrobe. Matt is probably on a water boat somewhere. Brendan Finn, the capable super producer, emerging in his own right. The dynamic, ever-aggressive Jamie Peck.
Hey.
And myself, we are all here. And actually, I would appreciate, you know what? Could somebody, we could do it over the break, but somebody should print out that Azalea and Grimes article. Because I was going to, Trevor and I were going to talk about it on TMBS. We didn't get to it because we ended up spending like 50 minutes making fun of Ben Shapiro using Movado music, doing different variations of Ben Shapiro hollering at women. Then we turned Ben Shapiro into a pickup artist with his own get woman scheme system. Which was all a lot of fun. It was a great show, but we didn't get to this Azalea Banks and Grimes story, which we will get to in the fun half. So don't worry about it now, but maybe somebody could print it out at some point over the next little while.
It would be my pleasure.
We will do that. We will have fun with that. That's a good one. That's a good one for us. That'll be a lot of fun. And I am curious your thoughts, actually, about Azalea Banks. I have mixed thoughts about her, so she'll be an interesting personality to get to. Donald Trump has revoked John Brennan's security clearance. Now, John Brennan, this is a good Rorschach test, okay? The resistance people would say this is a pitting of good versus evil. John Brennan was, at the very least, complicit in Bush-era torture programs and oversaw Obama's drone program, which has sort of endless legal, ethical, and international relations problems, plus domestic law problems. That's where the resistance is wrong. The QAnon idiots think that this is part of, you know, Trump exposing some type of, I don't know, pedophile rings or some nonsense. I think there is a dumb position which would accurately note all of the problems with Brennan, but still probably draw a false equivalency between him and the gang that's in there now, which I wouldn't. But something that we can all agree on, actually, probably from QAnon fantasists to democratic socialists, is that Paul Ryan is a disingenuous nothing. Who the fact that the mainstream press gave endless glowing profiles of in the Tea Party era should be an embarrassment to all, if they were capable of embarrassment themselves, and if we could ever feel anything akin to embarrassment for them, which, of course, we don't. A couple of weeks ago, this is 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
Reporters asked Paul Ryan, hey, do you take Donald Trump ranting and raving about revoking former CIA director's security clearance seriously? Paul Ryan, you know, usually he either goes, when, you know, Trump is saying something sexist or crazy on Twitter, he goes, I don't look at Twitter. In this case, he went to Plan B.
Some of these people have already lost their clearances. Some people keep their clearances. That's something that the executive branch deals with. It's not really in our purview. Yeah. I think he's just trolling people. Some of these people.
In a way, Donald Trump is just trolling people. That is basically his entire political career. But as we know, in 2018 in America, trolling can be very real. Trolling can lead to fascist rallies on the streets. Trolling can lead to Paul Ryan's entire domestic agenda to make America poorer, sicker, and dumber, getting signed by the executive branch. This can all come true. But for specifics of this story, Paul Ryan, wrong, disingenuous, and stupid again. You guys all right? Love it. Brendan gets very alpha in the producer's chair. I love it. He goes, don't worry about it. Just focus on the show. I dig it. Okay. Are you guys, though, taking care of everything? Is everything cool? Okay. Let me talk about BetterHelp. BetterHelp is affordable, private, online counseling. You get unlimited access to a licensed, trained, fully accredible therapist that's perfect for you on your phone and computer through text, voice, or video chat. They're LGBT-friendly. It's great for couples counseling or anything else you're going through in life right now. All you need to do is go to BetterHelp.com, fill out a questionnaire. They match you with a counselor who is perfect for you, and you can start counseling today. And if you decide you don't vibe with the therapist you're matched with, you can switch whenever you want. It's less expensive than in-person counseling, but you're still getting the same great help from a licensed professional. And if you have trouble affording it, BetterHelp even has financial aid available. That's awesome. You're always connected to your life counselor. You'll have unlimited access, which means you can talk with them every day if you want. If you connect from anywhere you are, at home, at work, or on the go. If you're not wasting time, traveling to someone's office and sitting around in a waiting room. A lot of people are not comfortable talking to a therapist in person, or they simply don't have the time, or they can't afford it. BetterHelp solves all of these problems. You could sign up right now and save on quality professional therapy by going to BetterHelp.com/majority. That's BetterHelp.com/majority. I should have mentioned the top line, Aretha Franklin. I believe she was 76 years old. She passed away today. Unbelievable American artist, icon, activist for civil rights, for women's rights. Just a truly singular talent. And somebody where it was like a genuine, like across the board. You could look on your Instagram as an example, and people from, you know, your baby boomer aunties and parents got and loved her. Your peers and younger got and loved her. So everybody's mourning, but also appreciating Aretha Franklin. And we will play her into the break, and then we will come back with Eric Levitz of New York Magazine.
Yeah, rest in power, Aretha Franklin.
Rest in power. Am I off camera?
Came out in front, and I was hiding. But now I'm so much better.
Welcome back to The Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Rest in power, Aretha Franklin. Joining us now is Eric Levitz. He's a politics writer for New York Magazine. Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Pleasure as always. Eric, you have a piece. We're going to get to a piece that I believe is just going up within minutes, if not already up, on the conundrum of the Nordic countries for the right in this country. But first, let's look at this new White House plan to ask judges to ask the Supreme Court to scrap Obamacare's consumer protections in September. You know, just to frame this, I mean, obviously, you know, Judge Kavanaugh will be a major blow for, you know, the non-ultra wealthy in this country across the board. And the midterms are for all of the things going on with Trump and, you know, and race and corruption and all of these major issues, it could be looked on really simply as a referendum on, you know, any type of attempt to preserve Obamacare, let alone move forward to, you know, a better position, a system like national health care. So what are they doing here? What are they specifically asking? And what are the consequences for the what remains of the Obamacare markets? And what could a Democratic Congress do, if anything?
Sure. So basically, a bunch of red states, you know, if you're a red state attorney general, what you do is try to find spurious reasons to kill Obamacare legally. And the fact that none of their previous attempts have worked has not sort of reduced the motivation to do that. So a bunch of red states got together and decided that because Republicans repealed the individual mandate in Obamacare, that means that they can't, you know, they promised insurance companies that they would force everybody to buy insurance, and in exchange, the insurers would not discriminate against people who have a history of mental illness or, you know, other pre-existing conditions. And they're saying, well, you got rid of the mandate, but you're still making them do that stuff, and that's unconstitutional, or that, you know, is a violation of the law. These two parts of the law are not severable from each other. So if the individual mandate is no longer standing, then the judiciary must strike down protections for people with pre-existing conditions. This argument is sort of even more absurd than the previous arguments that conservatives have made legally against Obamacare. Even I think the National Review wrote a negative opinion of the argument. But nonetheless, the Trump administration, which normally the federal government has like a duty that if any legally sustainable argument can be made in defense of a existing federal law, that the Justice Department is incumbent on them to argue for it. Mm-hmm. But Jeff Sessions said that he could not find any argument against this red state case, and therefore was not going to contest it. And is it possible that the right wing judges, on the appeals court and on the Supreme Court will be so craven as to accept this? It's possible, but really it seems more like just a political own goal for the Republican Party and for the Trump administration, which the Democratic Party's number one goal, both in the fight over Kavanaugh and in the midterm elections, is to increase the salience of healthcare policy and remind voters about that time that congressional Republicans tried to, throw 22 million people off their health insurance, which was the single most unpopular thing the Republican Party has done since Trump took office, tanked both his approval rating and the Republican standing in the generic ballot when Paul Ryan introduced that bill in the House. And remains in polls. By far, voters prefer the Democrats on the issue of health care by double digits. So their entire goal was to make sure that this was still an issue heading into November. And the Trump administration, by backing not only a challenge to Obamacare, but a challenge to the most popular part of Obamacare. Protections for pre-existing conditions are so popular that actually when Republicans, even in their Obamacare appeal bill, which would have done a lot of horrific things, throwing people off Medicaid, and a bunch of cutting federal health care spending, they still preserved a version of protections for pre-existing conditions because even Paul Ryan wasn't willing to take the heat that was generating.
So is this just an example of the sort of – because on the other hand, okay, so Democrats want to drive turnout based on how unpopular Republican healthcare policies are. And there's going to be no normal person, obviously no Democratic voter, no Democratic-leaning voter. There's going to be no of whatever, you know, minuscule amount, whatever handful of people who might be sort of you know, all over the place voters, swing voters, are going to like Republican proposals to, you know, hand over people's, you know, well-being to HMOs or destroy federal health spending. This stuff is categorically massively unpopular. On the other hand, obviously Republicans are in a place where, it is just even more so about getting the real crazies, the real diehards. I mean, this is why Bannon's back. He's getting funding for some type of new documentary, Trump at War. And this is the type of people that, you know, they're not even the sort of old, you know, like the split that someone like Thomas Frank might have identified. Like, these people might have, you know, arch reactionary social views, but they also might understand, obviously, that Republican policies with regards to government spending and the economy are, you know, bad for you unless you're, a millionaire. The Trump Republican base now does seem, you know, they're the type of people who, you know, Alex Jones said protection for pre-existing, you know, conditions will make your kid transgender or something. So therefore, I have to vote because of the Muslim Brotherhood. So is there a rhyme, or is that potentially part of what's going on? Is that, yes, in the broad landscape of sentient humans, reminding people of an attempt to, you know, literally cut people's lifespans, 20 million people's lifespans, and make it so that you can't get health care if you've ever dealt with a medical issue, is not popular. But for the true nutcases that need to turn out, this is just another, you know, battle against Obama's Al-Qaeda plot or something.
Yeah, I don't think there's a political calculus here. I think this is all ideological. I think Jeff Sessions didn't want to sully himself by defending Barack Obama's health care law in court. The people who actually are so geared into Republican politics that they are passionate about, you know, getting their, nephew who has, you know, bipolar disorder, making them unable to be able to afford health care, those people are already going to turn out. I mean, that's
right.
the diehard Republican base.
Right.
And Republicans don't want to talk about this issue. If you're looking at their ads, they don't mention health care at all to the extent that they have. You saw in the special election last week in Ohio, Troy Balderson, the Republican candidate, accused his Democratic rival totally mendaciously of supporting cuts to Medicare. They do not want to campaign as the party that wants to eliminate government benefits for health care. That's not what they want.
Right. So basically, Jeff Sessions, and one could comfortably speculate that there's any number of like, it would be one thing to, you know, defend the law that Bill Clinton did, but Barack Obama, I mean, I think, yeah, right. We all know who Jeff Sessions is. Okay, so you have a piece that I actually don't know if it's been posted yet. We're hot off of the presses with it, dealing with how the American right talks about and understands Nordic countries. There's this notion that it's a conflict on the left. I think that there's interesting and worthwhile debates between, you know, a democratic socialist and social democratic position on the left that deals with the Nordic countries. There's obviously a critique and a debate around, diversity and homogeneity and universal programs that implicates the Scandinavian countries. And some of these conversations are worthwhile and interesting. Sometimes they're disingenuous. But on the right, you've identified this incredible, almost like schizophrenic split in how they're understanding the Nordics. What is that split?
Yeah, well, basically, there's one part of the conservative, one set of conservative intellectuals who is still doing the sort of old-time religion of, you know, any major government program is just, it's a step on the road to serfdom. It's, you know, you can't have free health care without, leading to jailing political prisoners or something, and basically describing the Nordic countries as, a totalitarian nightmare, not distinguishing it from Venezuela, which is itself not quite a totalitarian nightmare, but obviously a less desirable model, and not distinguish it from, Stalinist Russia. And then on the other hand, there's this more libertarian inclined part of the movement that has discovered that actually, the Heritage Foundation and Cato and these other right-wing think tanks have these weird, like, freedom indexes where they take a bunch of different economic indicators and score, like, how free your country is. And remarkably, sort of bizarrely, their indicators list, like, Denmark as being more capitalist than the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're saying, like, oh, no, the left is wrong, actually. The Nordic countries aren't democratic socialist or social democratic. They aren't totalitarian. They're free market capitalist. And that's why they've been so successful. Both of these responses basically reflect just the intellectual bankruptcy of the right on economic issues. Basically, the American people do not think that, an ideal economic policy is one that minimizes the tax burden borne by wealthy individuals and corporate America's labor costs, which is what the right wing is committed to. Most people say, do I want low tax rates on the rich or do I want a low poverty rate? I would for like poor children. I want the latter. And the right has always relied on the idea that, the first order effects of our agenda aren't popular. Yeah, I know you might not like, weak bargaining power for workers and low taxes on the rich and, no significant benefits for your family. You don't get free childcare like they get over there. But this system produces higher levels of economic growth and higher levels of innovation. And you know what? It's going to be worthwhile in the end. The rising tide lifts all boats. Mm-hmm. And the Nordics, they're the most socialistic countries in Europe, and they're also host growth rates comparable to the United States, and they also produce, more patents that are registered in multiple countries. This is, that they gave birth to Kazaa, they really advanced in driverless cars. So they're innovative, they're high growth. And they also have cradle-to-grave welfare, like an 80% unionization rate. And so the right is left in this position of, they desperately want to be able to, where's the Soviet Union when you need it? They need a boogeyman. They're left sort of stammering and not sure what to do about the fact that that the social democratic model, which has its own problems, but nonetheless, relative to the American model, is working so much better.
No doubt. So before, what are some examples of, we'll talk about this synthesis that the Nordic countries have that provides the best of both worlds relative to the United States, but what kind of policies make them rank highly on a freedom index? What are those, what kind of policies are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little strange. I think a lot of it is basically they're very pro free trade, which makes sense because these are tiny, cold little countries that, if they're going to have competitive firms, they need to sell to the world. They don't have a large enough domestic market,
right,
and they don't have enough natural resources to not need to import. So they're very pro free trade, by necessity. So there's that. There's also, this is an incredible concession in this Cato Institute report on Denmark, which is like trying to, galaxy brain liberals that actually know Denmark is pretty capitalist. It says if you put the welfare state aside, everything else, that they do, they have no minimum wage, which they have no minimum wage because it's unnecessary because everyone's in a union and everyone's wage is pretty high. But nonetheless, they have no minimum wage. They have, they have like less occupational licensing or something. But they say that Denmark is, according to a certain index, the least corrupt government on planet Earth, which is just a remarkable concession, like even by their logic, which ignores a lot of aspects of the way that, the Nordic countries are actually very pretty darn socialist. Even if you stipulate that, like, the only socialist thing about them is a giant welfare state that, you know, gives guarantees like 6 weeks of vacation to like every citizen like each year and yada, yada, yada. The right's whole argument is that you can't, that the big government is inherently corrupt, that the government that governs best governs least. And now you're saying as a libertarian think tank that actually the government that governs best is the one that governs most, that one of the largest, most ambitious public sectors, you know, in the world is also the cleanest. That's a remarkable concession for the right to make. And it's bizarre that it's a reflection of desperation that they're actually stumbling on that.
Yeah. So basically what it seems to me is that you're describing, I mean, first of all, okay, there's totally disingenuous things like minimum wage isn't on the book because it's a unionized society. So therefore workers are just better off, period. There. And not only do they have union protections, there's more, you know, a kind of cooperative decision making between government and the unions and the private sector. And there's much more of a kind of sense of, like, you know, cohesive strategy, so that, you know, firm planning includes things like increasing wages, and, you know, a broader distribution of the benefits is sort of pre-baked into the system and the power structure, which is, you know, obviously antithetical to all of the libertarian and neoliberal extremism that is, you know, obviously a product of the right in the United States, but also, you know, the center and many people identify on the center left. And then there's this other kind of interesting sort of it reminds me of Matt Taibbi, I think, wrote, I forget what book it was, but he went and spent time with these Tea Party guys in, I think, Westchester County. And when they were talking about their very, very specific small problems, and, you know, not small for them, just but stuff that just doesn't, you know, it might cumulatively have an effect on people running small businesses, and as an example, but it's certainly not like, you know, big frontline important national issues like regulating banks or, you know, taming Silicon Valley or reunionizing America, right? But there were a lot of kind of legitimate gripes about, you know, how many licensing fees do I have to pay, you know, to process paperwork at the local, you know, whatever, or, you know, different ways that government contracts might be distributed locally in ways that were, you know, crony and favored kind of local political favoritism. Although, ironically, that's another thing that would undermine libertarian arguments, because a lot of, you know, smaller scale places have even worse corruption scandals than, right, you know, national level. So that's another thing, another kind of libertarian myth about scale that's easily debunked by reality. But the point being that in the United States, you could actually identify a whole set of bureaucratic kind of log jams, some of which might even be legitimately things that are, you know, unfair or unhelpful to people running small scale businesses. And then people took that and it was extrapolated, like, see, just as I'm overregulated, so is Jamie Dimon, right? Which is, of course, you know, crazy, because obviously, you know, pharma and banks and all these other interests are the ones that run and write the political process. But the point being that maybe in certain parts of business, particularly on a small scale, there actually could be – government could be used in a collaborative way to sort of protect incumbent businesses, which is another thing that libertarians say a lot, although they sort of reverse the order. It's somehow government's fault and not a sort of aggressive monopolistic private sector that has corrupted government. But maybe in Scandinavia what we're seeing is, like – again, and this is what they call with, like, flexicurity is one of the phrases that come out of the Nordic countries. This idea that on one hand, when it comes to sort of like thinking of a business idea or engaging in the market in a certain way, there should be freedom to challenge monopolies. There shouldn't be lockdowns on opportunities to participate. Obviously, that's ensured through government regulation. A good example here would have been, you know, net neutrality until the Republicans governed that, right? That's a government rule ensuring a certain level of level playing field in the tech sector to some small extent, which allowed for some small scale and participation in innovation. That type of regulation, which allows markets to genuinely have some competition, which you can't have without government regulation. And then it's coupled with powerful union sector, powerful social sector, and then universal mass distribution through things like robust universal healthcare, free college, and all sorts of other mass public investments. And of course, just to put on the table here too, you know, very serious environmental regulations, which is another thing that they don't want to contend with either. But does that kind of synthesis actually make sense, right? Like, they could be literally wrong on both accounts. Like, first, totally wrong about the scale of the welfare state and what that means about the nature of government, and of course their own sort of, you know, own goal with Denmark being the least corrupt. But even in the ways in which these countries actually do ensure that there is a level of kind of small, you know, business innovation and participation is actually through government sort of enforcing the rules of the road. And there might be opportunity to, you know, in small ways, like help people in, you know, small business sector or whatever. I mean, it's a very abused phrase in the United States, but you get my point.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that that all makes sense. I think one thing I'd add is that, you know, I think part of what you're seeing is that, you know, we're in a country where one major party, like, has a very strong investment in making the government not work well, mm-hmm. and making your experience with the government bad, you know, and that this is really informed. I mean, it informs how the Republicans, you know, have handled Obamacare, you know, which we've got other problems. We've also got another party that, you know, is so compromised by certain interests that they also inadvertently make interfacing with the government less pleasant than it should be. But you see it with that, also with their tax plan. You know, in other countries, the government has enough information on you that it could send you your taxes each year pre-filled out, and you just sign it, make sure there's no errors, and then sign it. And there's been proposals for this, but the combination of, you know, TurboTax and these lobbies for people who help you with your taxes, with, or I think a genuine Republican investment, and they want you to have a really unpleasant experience filling out your taxes every year, you know, because they want your association with the government to be a burden. And so I think that part of what you're seeing in the Scandinavian countries is if you have a country that actually believes, you know, in the role of government, and all major parties want to actually, like, you know, serve their constituents in a way that they like, you're going to get cleaner government, you're going to get more effective and less, you know, less bureaucratic government, arguably, than what the Republican Party actually wants there to be in the United States.
That's another funny thing, right, is decoupling the idea of, like, bureaucratic nightmares being associated with the public sector. Like, it's so funny to me that it's like always, yes, it's like the IRS and the DMV. Everybody hates those. Although I actually – what's funny, I mean, my IRS agents could actually be quite helpful on the phone, contrary to some of the mythology. But everybody – like, people don't like those places, and it's pretty obvious why they don't for a variety of reasons. But why isn't there, like, a big – you know, cultural myth about, I mean, first of all, the obvious thing would be, you know, fighting with your healthcare provider that's, like, literally trying to kill you to, like, increase a profit margin or rob you of care. But even down to, like, the levels that they harp on, like, you know, you call your, you know, you think you don't have to wait on the phone forever if you call your bank or Verizon. You don't think you're, you know, you aren't, you know, you aren't dealing with all of the hallmarks of an unaccountable, inhumane bureaucracy. Except in this case, without even the notion that there's some type of public accountability to you. Like, they're just private sector, you know, money funneling machines just there to decouple you from your bank account as much as possible. Like, that's their sole purpose.
Absolutely.
Is there? Do you think there's some hay that can be made out of that? Like, hey, you want to talk about, like, big bureaucracies that are unaccountable, let's talk about the corporations that you interface with and rob you every single day and give you terrible customer service. You think there's some worth?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that some Democrats are starting to do that a little bit. I mean, I think with, you know, both antitrust stuff and also on the idea of funding a public option for the internet, mm-hmm. Especially for, you know, municipalities in rural areas that don't have access to it. Like, leveraging the fact that, like, the DMV is unpopular, but I would wager that, like, Comcast and these cable companies are, like, even more. Like, these cable monopolies,
yeah.
people hate them. And you know, forcing Republicans, you know, if Democrats can get free enough from the influence of these companies to take advantage of it, forcing Republicans to stand for Comcast against, like, consumers on any issue seems like a no-brainer as far as the politics of it are concerned.
Yes, I agree with you completely, and I think that we can, you know, we can sort of, and I think the last thing I want to run by you, I think, look, there was, in some ways, some of it was substantive because I, you know, it's obviously an important thing to put on the table with regards to talking about the Scandinavian model, to acknowledge the, you know, distinct, obviously, history of white supremacy in the United States and just the complexity of the United States. And I also think, conversely, I say this always, and some people get it or they don't, I'm not a defender of Maduro. There's plenty of self-generated problems and crises generated in Venezuela, but also that's an incredibly disingenuous, you know, comparison to harp on Venezuela, which is a, you know, poorer country, which had, by the way, you know, disparities in an oligarchy before Chavez, which was much more analogous to the United States than something you'd see in the Nordics, and has also been a place that has had endless U.S. interference from intelligence agencies and, you know, natural resource industry. So, you know, that's a very – I think that we, with regards to Venezuela, without justifying or supporting the Maduro government, also need to do a little bit more pushback on the, like, wow, you mean you're telling me that, you know, a poorer country – with distinct problems of corruption and populism in a government of Chavez and Maduro, not having nothing to do with socialism, and with endless U.S. interference and reaction from that country's oligarchy, hasn't produced at the topmost standard. Well, what a shock, right? Like,
yeah.
Okay. And now, by the way, let's go over a list of any number of, you know, far right and fascistic, you know, developing countries which you support, which have even worse human indicators than Venezuela. So I think that can be, you know, both go ahead.
I mean, like, by the same token, though, like, I think that's all right, but just in terms of the partisan debate within the U.S., I think those are all also reasons, though, why, like, the, you know, you want to reject and wipe away the Venezuela thing, because the idea that, like, America's experience with, say, being a country with a state-owned oil enterprise, that would instantly plunge us into conditions analogous to Venezuela rather than analogous to other advanced developed democracies that are very extremely wealthy. Yeah, exactly, like Norway.
Right.
I mean, it's absurd, because what they're doing with that is equating socialism with the disadvantageous conditions that you know, Venezuela is unjustly subject to, but that is just fundamentally irrelevant to the American context.
Not unless Trump has his way for another couple of terms. We could be heading there. We could be like, it's time for nationalization. But it seems to me that there has to be a way of, you know, not always, you know, pointing to the Nordics and not, you know, blindly defending them, but at the same time, not overcorrecting. I mean, we can own in the discourse that actually there are countries that have pursued the types of policies that are actually overwhelmingly popular with Americans, that people like Bernie Sanders are advocating. And you know what? They're far from perfect. They have plenty of problems, but they produced an incredible amount of good. And, you know, we can stand on that and fight on that clearly.
Yeah. I think I will say, you know, because something that is happening right now is that there is a far right rising in Sweden for welfare chauvinism. And it is like one of the right's valid arguments. It's not actually an argument against the model, but it's just a political argument about whether or not it's basically an argument for why they might be successful in defeating something that most Americans would want, which is that, you know, divide and conquer does kind of work. And resentment of immigrants is a real phenomenon, and that the heterogeneity of American society is a political challenge to, implementing any really just economic system.
Right. That's the challenge and the reality, but not a reason not to, and also not a reason to not point to places that, without glorifying them, and obviously Sweden being the, you know, obvious example, with a really deep history in Sweden of some very far right and very racist politics, that still, you know, these places have delivered and they have produced a lot of gains, and they're no utopia by any stretch of imagination, but there's something to model there.
Right.
Now, speaking of divide and conquer, racism, white supremacy, and just the sort of truly disgusting nature of the United States in 2018, Mr. Burnett, I forget, was it Mark Burnett? Mark Burnett, the producer of The Apprentice.
I think it's Mark.
Mark Burnett has assured Donald Trump that he has never used that word. And by the way, Donald Trump would like you to know that it's a really ugly word and it's not part of his vocabulary. Omarosa is strongly implying otherwise. And it's been really fun to watch her just continually be as gross as Trump and beat him at his own game, like down to like she says they said something and then they lie about it and then she releases a tape is pretty funny. What do you make of all this? I mean, first of all, I'm assuming you would obviously assume there must be a tape of him saying, I would imagine, all sorts of disgusting things. But also, you know, like, what do you think this does to Trump? Like, what is the fallout from this?
Yeah, I don't know. There's so many ridiculous aspects to this. I mean, there's the fact that the Trump administration, like, the guy literally, like, wanted his, like, it could have even been his campaign slogan, like, I hire the best people. And then he spent, like, his, like, first, like, year and a half in office, like, just firing one person after another and then tweeting about what an awful, ridiculous person they are and how they never should have had their job, which is just nuts. Omarosa, to her credit, did, I believe, confirm the long-rumored story that Trump was forcing all government employees, like within the White House, to sign non-disclosure agreements, which is not legal. And so she genuinely, like, blew a whistle on that, I believe, independent of her other sort of ridiculous or seemingly ridiculous allegations, like that Trump, like, eats memos.
Does that really sound that ridiculous to you?
I believe maybe you shouldn't.
I believe
but,
it.
Yeah, so, you know, if you look at, I'm sure that Trump has said all kinds of, I don't know if you remember, do you remember the scandal with Trump's butler in 2016?
No, remind us.
Trump's longtime butler at Mar-a-Lago, they discovered he had all these Facebook posts that were just about, going to the White Mosque, as in White House, and like getting that, I forget exactly what he referred to Obama as, but stringing him up on the portico, like lynching Obama.
Wow.
Many other things like that about how, like, we should, like, kill that Muslim president. And this was his, like, longtime butler and personal friend. It's really difficult for me. I mean, can you imagine Trump and his butler sitting around the pool and his butler saying something like that, and Trump saying, like, hey, you shouldn't say that. This country has, like, a really, like, scarred history of racism, and it's not okay to, you know, joke about lynching Obama. Like, I like you, but you should. I mean, obviously, I don't think that Trump's going to be doing that. So
we have
Trump
a really, really, really destructive history. You should read Notes on Native Son. Notes of a Native Son. Watch Eyes on the Prize. Totally change how you think about that.
Stamp from the beginning.
Real bad stuff. Stamp from the beginning. Amazing book. I mean, you know, IQ test. I mean, it's just pseudoscience to justify oppression. Anyways, we're going to put that she has a different birth date on the call logs, okay? That would actually be a funny character. Like, Trump is himself in every other way. He's just like this horrible human being, but he's just like super, like, on it when it comes to race.
Yeah, just get structural.
Yeah, I just, no. It's a Facebook post for you, but it's a whole history for them. I think obviously with his base, it doesn't make – although I keep getting struck by, did you watch that CNN focus group? I think it was a week ago, and there was a couple of Trump voters that have flipped on him. And one guy is just this middle-aged white dude, and he just was like, he's racist. And naturally, the woman is like, I forget who, I think it was Allison Camerata. I think that was who was hosting. And she's like, you know, she kept her professionalism, but maybe I'm projecting here. But I do think she was genuinely being like, you know, what makes you say that now? Like, when is this guy not? Like, the guy literally announced his campaign by saying racist stuff about Mexicans. And he just like, well, he called LeBron an idiot. And it's like, well, you know, and I'm whatever. I'm glad that guy's on board now. But that was the thing, was Trump being an asshole to, you know, a guy like LeBron, where you would have to be, you know, if you don't like LeBron, like, what's your problem, right? Like, you know, and so maybe there are a tiny, 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 minuscule handful of people that support Trump, where if they heard him actually saying that, that would somehow be the, you know, water in the face, and they'd wake up about the nature of this guy. But maybe from the perspective of the mainstream press, and I think Sam said this too, if that tape comes out, the sort of playing around, like, they still are giving him these like ridiculous, laughable kind of equivalencies and benefit of the doubt, and it will just be out there, and he will have just said that, and then it will be like, you know, we have to just cover it as this guy's a racist buffoon. And maybe that just adds another nail into the coffin of, you know, any bit of sort of credibility or respectability about this guy. I mean, I can't imagine any existing to begin with, but you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it would matter politically. I think that there, Trump has some soft supporters still, not a lot, but, you know, he has such a low ceiling that he's got to keep everybody he's got on board. And I think that there are, it also depends, like, when it breaks and how, I don't know. I think that the polls genuinely did move against Trump dramatically after the Access Hollywood thing.
Yep.
And then voters had enough time to, like, just forget it. You know, and so, but so if an N-word tape came out, you know, right before the midterms or right before, you know, the 2020 election, I think it would sink him, and maybe it would regardless. It is like kind of like frustrating, obviously. I think it would matter politically because I think that most Americans do understand racism as like this private like thing of like honoring certain like speech and like civil codes,
right,
or whatever. But it is like I just was thinking, you know, with what he's like, if Donald Trump called for banning all Jews from the United States and instructed the Department of Homeland Security to publish each week a weekly list of like crimes committed by Jews, and held like rallies where with the mothers of like kids who were murdered by Jews, and like compared them to animals, and then like someone said, hey, you know, there might be a secret tape of him saying kite. You know, I can't imagine caring about that. And I like, you know, the his public racism is both enough to very clearly establish that he's a racist,
right,
personally, and then also is like so much more of a threat to vulnerable minorities in the United States. Like, what matters is what he does in public, not what he says in private. Like, he shouldn't say that in private. Lyndon Johnson shouldn't have like said that in private.
Right,
but, like,
right.
At the same time, it didn't matter as much as what he did like with political power.
Well, no, that's exactly, no, that's how totally distorted the conversation. And that's also why, you know, okay, so that's actually a great juxtaposition, right? Like, Lyndon Baines Johnson kept up this, you know, horrible rhetoric and probably some really bad personal attitudes in private, and then legislated in a way that was really good. And then, you know, and then, you know, Trump is racist and sexist across the board. And then, like, I don't know, you know, I'm sure, you know, Reagan, you know, oh, he was very classy to, you know, black people in his personal relationships. And maybe he didn't say things. I mean, I'm sure he did say some racist things, but he probably didn't use slurs, and he probably didn't, you know, that type of stuff. Meanwhile, he's waging a war on urban America. He's using white backlash politics every second of the day. Klan memberships are spiking, and he vetoes sanctions against South Africa. So he's, of course, a functionally white supremacy based president. And I think you're right that the structural problem it points to is the inability to understand racism as a fuller thing, of which obviously not only Trump, but all Republican leadership would fit under, and a lot of Democrats. I mean, Bill Clinton, frankly, at some points in his career would absolutely fit my definition. But, you know, it does take that, you know, kind of like, well, you can't say that word. And, you know, it. And so, and I also, You were getting into my comedy lizard brain. I was thinking it would be like you know, a kid who their son was in debt to a Jewish Shylock, right? Trump would be like, Shylock won't forgive the debt. Got to figure out what the hell's going on. But that's perfect, right? Yes. If there were a list of Jewish crimes, Jewish people are animals, Jewish people are banned from the country. I mean, how could there be any question for a second as to what this stuff is? And by the way, absolutely with regards to, you know, Black Americans, but are you kidding? I mean, with Muslims and people from Latin America,
like, you can't understand American politics if you don't, like, stipulate that, like, it's just genuinely in our culture, bigotry against Muslims is fundamentally, like, more okay than any other kind of bigotry.
Right.
Otherwise, you can't, like, you know, I mean, the White House is staffed by people who came from think tanks that put out reports calling for, like, shutting down 80% of America's mosques. Like, there is no conversation about whether this is an anti-Semitic president. If, you know, those were synagogues, you know, the whole conversation proceeds from the premise that, like, you know, it's fundamentally acceptable to, like, be pretty darn bigoted. But, like, you know, even African Americans have more social capital right now, you know, that you can't. Yeah.
Well, we're working on that. That's for the second term. I mean, this is as good a time as any as we head into it, that for all of the many, many problems with Democrats and critiques and needs for street activism, it's time to register. Make sure you vote in these midterms. Eric Levitz, political writer for New York Magazine, I really appreciate your time as always.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. All right, folks. We are going to go to the fun half in just a moment. Become a member of the Majority Report today. That's how this show happens, majority.fm/become a member. Become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show today at patreon.com/TMBS. T, Trevor Bolyu and I, he's the co-host of Champagne Sharks. He's a really smart guy. You should check him out. We did an extended bit on Ben Shapiro, AOC, entitlement, but also the Ben Shapiro pickup artistry system bit. Paul Robeson, commentary and analysis on why the West does not exist. There's an economic update. Check out the show if you haven't done it yet. This Sunday, an illicit history and primer on Saudi strategy in the Middle East, what's happening in Yemen, the atrocities there, and relationships to the Trump administration through nexuses of money that wash out of the Gulf. Really good stuff. There's also now a YouTube channel for the Michael Brooks Show, which we're just shy of our first 6,000 subscribers. So go check that out. Subscribe, share those clips, and become a patron today. Or if you haven't checked it out yet, check out the full show on the YouTube channel or subscribe to it on iTunes, patreon.com/TMBS. Thanks, everybody. On Antifada, there was something about UFOs.
Indeed.
Is this... I listened to part of it. Is it comedy or is this like an actual thing? Is the dude you had on joking or is he for real?
That's an excellent question. You know, I think it's a little bit of both. If I may venture a guess after talking to him for a while, spending some time with him. I mean, that's kind of what the whole episode is about, actually, because... You know, most people who've heard of Posadism have seen it sort of in meme form, like on the internet. You've seen like the jokes about like the space comrades and the terrestrial Stalinist versus the Posadist Chad, you know.
I have not
perhaps
seen these things.
I will have to.
I dip in a different pop culture.
I will have to show it to you.
Yes.
But we basically go back and forth the whole time because Posadist was both like a real figure in the mainstream Trotskyist movement in Latin America. Oh, shit. Is it going dark? I'll switch back to Michael's shot. He was a real figure in the Trotskyist movement in Latin America, as well as a cult figure who synthesized Trotskyist Marxism with ufology starting in the late 1960s, where, I mean, not just crazy people thought that this was a real possibility in the late 60s. Like, we have government documents where like the American government and the Soviet government were like agreeing to band together to fight the aliens if there was a space invasion.
Did you ever see that? I was a really interesting Adam Curtis documentary, and this is moving ahead. Probably, I forget what the dates on this were, but I bet the United States that they were doing this all along. There was a guy who was a UFO whistleblower, and what literally happened was he got played. He intentionally, intelligence services gave him fake documents because essentially what they wanted to do was basically distract from the testing of incredibly sophisticated weapon systems. And so like turn like military industrial complex stuff into UFO stuff. It was interesting.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. There's definitely a lot of disinformation involved, and a lot of stuff has come out about that since the 60s. But yeah, the whole thing is crazy.
It's totally crazy.
You can listen on iTunes, Fans FM, Spotify, Stitcher. We got a YouTube channel now, youtube.com/TheAntifada. And we also have a bonus coming out for our patrons over the weekend. We did a Real Posadas Hours on an essay by Jay Posadas that was actually never published called On the Function of the Joke and Irony in History.
Hmm.
Spoiler alert, he was not being ironic.
Yeah, I was going to say, that doesn't sound... I'm not trying to offend anybody out there, but from what I've heard about this guy, that's not his lane. I would
yeah, stay, no.
I would get out of that lane. Leave that lane to
yeah,
others.
Yeah, fair enough.
To others more in the irony and joke lane. Brendan, anything you want to plug?
No plugs.
Oh, by the way, well, we could say... This past TMBS, both last show and post game, were very ably manned by Brendan Finn.
Yes, folks. Very I was good featured job. On the most recent TMBS, filling in for the valiant young Matt Leck. Check it out. It was a lot of fun. I had a great time. And I hope to do it again soon, unless you guys didn't like it, in which case I don't want to do it again.
I don't want to. I like when your Jersey accent comes out, dude. I don't want to do it again. Obviously, Matt Leck, Literary Hangover. Check it out. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks! Fucking reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?